Welcome one and all to The Fix here on KXRW. I am Bill Haas, so very happy to have you here. Check this out. The song we are listening to right now is called Doggies Must Play, and the man having it all his own way is internationally renowned jazz saxophonist, composer, teacher, and band leader, St. Paul, Minnesota's own Pat Mallinger, who is currently the leader of Pat Mallinger & Company and the straw that stirs the drink every Saturday night at the late night jazz party at the very famous Green Mill Jazz Club in Uptown Chicago. I caught up with Pat to speak with him about his career and catalog of songs, including his latest release, Perspectives, 3 alto saxophones. Let's hear all about it.
Pat Mallinger, thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. You started playing pretty early. I always, to start at the beginning, 11, is that when you first picked it up?
That's correct.
And I don't know the configuration of your family. Were there any other sax players in your family?
Well, not in my immediate family, but my uncle, Tommy Bauer, is actually not my uncle, but I didn't know that growing up. We call him uncle. He's my dad's cousin. Tommy Bauer is integral part of the Twin Cities jazz society scene, and he was indoctrinated in the Twin Cities Hall of Fame, Jazz Hall of Fame.
Indeed.
Great musician. People know his name there, and I used to go hear him play a lot at the Mancini's Supper Club. He used to play organ, actually, during those days.
Is Mancini any relation to Henry?
No.
Oh, no.
But it's a famous steakhouse in Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Uh-huh.
And he used to play the organ and the saxophone at the same time.
Oh, is that right?
I don't know how he did it. Even one hand on the saxophone, one hand on the organ. And they're in two different keys, too. So go figure out how you do that.
Sure. Yeah. Is there a Glenn Miller connection with?
Well, that's interesting. You got a good memory. Because he apparently had played with Glenn Miller, Tommy Bauer. And so the horn I got when I began was a gift from Tommy and Tommy Bauer. And so that's what I played forever and up until high school. Then I upgraded to a newer horn, Selmer. But yeah, I still have Tommy's horn that I started out on, and the alto saxophone. Yeah.
Oh, you still have the horn?
I still have the horn, yeah.
First album, Happy Feet, at age 14?
That's funny. Well, you did some research.
I did a little bit.
That's great. Yes, that's correct, actually. Happy Feet is our junior high school album. It's a double album.
I understand.
And there's a whole side of Jazz One, So another side of jazz, two, and then the other concert bands. But yeah, we went into the studio and laid it down. They burned it on wax, and I still put it on every once in a while.
Yeah.
Still.
I mean, it's pretty interesting for you to have gotten a taste of recording, or gotten a taste. You're playing, I suppose you'd say, an ensemble, a band. Right. You're in a band.
Right.
And starting at a pretty early age to understand what it means to not only to play, but to listen and to play off of other musicians.
Yeah, and I'll go back to what you were saying. It was 1979 or 1978, maybe, when we recorded that album. It was two-inch tape, you know, so we watched that, you know, watch that big tape, you know, recording us, you know. And it's funny because nowadays that's what people prefer to go back to, recording on the thick tape.
But yeah, you bet.
Yeah, and then they literally, if they had to splice it, literally had to splice.
Put it down, take out the razor blade and the little...
Exactly.
When you left Minnesota...
I went first to University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire, and did a year there and transferred to Texas, North Texas, for three years. So.
And then what did you come out of there with?
I came out of there with my jazz studies degree. Mm-hmm. And immediately hopped on a ship, worked on ships for 7 months. Immediately after that, went to Minnesota briefly, and then I decided I was moving to Boston. So I headed to Boston, mm-hmm. basically from the ships.
And spent how much time there?
In Boston, like 3-4 years in there.
Playing.
Right, there was a period in 1989 where I hopped on the circus. I joined the circus, Ringling Brothers.
Okay.
They were going to Tokyo and Osaka. They were going to Japan, and I really wanted to go to Japan. And my roommate was going with them, and he one day came over and said, hey, you want to go to Japan? We're going to Japan. And I said, well, yeah, I want to go to Japan. He said, all right, you know, we're going to be there.
So you're playing with the Ringling Brothers.
Yeah, exactly. So I did what was supposed to be 6 months there, but we stayed 7 months there. It was quite the experience, yeah. And I saved up quite a bit of money, you know, which I eventually was able to buy a house here. You know?
So you came from, after your experience with Ringling Brothers, you came to Chicago.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Well, it was either New York or here. So I remember, like, I was in Dorchester, Boston, south side of Boston, and Mike Zavarella, he's still there, Silvio, a bass player, well, he was a bass player on the circus, and he, on his top floor, which was like the third floor of the big house he had, but I remember practicing up on the top, and I had a map. I was into maps then, and I was AAA, right? And I'd order all these maps, and so I had a map of Minnesota there, you know. But I didn't need that. I knew Minnesota, but I on the wall I had two big maps. I had the wall of Chicago and then New York, and I would practice up there for a summer, and it was hot. So I was up there in that like attic, kind of third, fourth floor, and I'd practice and go to one map and just look at it, study all the others of the map, and then I'd go back to New York and I'd look at that and I'd practice that, and I, you know, basically kind of just feeling it out, you know, where am I going to go? Am I going to go to New York or Chicago? And then my brother called. He lived here, and he was like, hey, Pat, you want to come here? You can come and live in the rectory. And I said, oh, really? He said, yeah, the priest here, Dennis, is super cool, and he said we could convert the upstairs attic into a bedroom, and I said awesome. So
you land in Chicago. What church was that?
That's funny because I immediately moved in 83rd and Calumet, which is Chatham. It's far south side, and I think most of the people assumed I was a priest, and all the neighbors and everybody, you know. I mean, I'd jog around Nat King Cole Park, which was right around the kitty corner, and, you know, I was, of course, one of the very few white people anywhere around that saw. I think, yeah, people would see us sometimes, they'd say, "Hey, Father." So assume I was a priest, you know, and I was a regular there. I lived there, so, but it was a great community. Ed Thigpen, the great drummer, he was part of the congregation, so I'd see him, and we had the whole basement, and I'd have little jams down there, little evening parties, where some of the members of the congregation would come, and we'd be spinning sides. They'd have a DJ, and we had a couple guys in the basement
of the rectory.
In the basement of the rectory, yeah, the rectory parties were pretty famous, and it's quite a scene, and everybody had a great time. It was just a great mix of the community, because they all loved jazz, right? So they knew we were playing jazz, and then the word got out that we were down in the basement playing jazz, and they would come, you know, and of course they loved it, and we had it. Yeah, for great experiences, some of my friends from the North Side would come and we'd play. And yeah, it was just, I mean, it was really great. Another great thing about that experience was the practicing. Dennis he gave me the key to the church. Every once in a while, I would trigger the alarm, you know, at night by accidentally, because it's an old school button kind of alarm. And if you didn't do that clockwise, counterclockwise, right or whatever, it could trigger the alarm. And I was always practicing late, you know, all hours of the. I've always been a late guy, so I'm in there at 2 a.m, you know, in this church in the South Side, you know, just bellowing out. I just love the sound and the feel and the spirituality of being there, you know, and there were jazz clubs. Really close at that point. There was the other place, which had a Hammond B3 organ, and I played there with Charles Erlin. And then I'd go here, and the locals play there, play the organ, and yeah, it was just a great, great scene. And of course, the new apartment lounge was just 10 blocks south of me, so I could get there in 5 minutes to the new apartment lounge, great Fon Freeman, of course, and Michael Rayner, who is from Portland and was the drummer there for a very long time, and with Vaughn, and a lot of my good friends too, Mike Allman and Matt Ferguson.
Okay, let's hear a few minutes of Smile by Pat Mallinger and check in with a couple of our sponsors. You are listening to The Fix here on KXRW.
KXRW would like to thank Craft Cannabis, our exclusive cannabis sponsor, for supporting our radio community. Their wide variety of products range from edibles, pre-rolls, concentrates, vapes, CBD topicals, tinctures, and much more. Craft Cannabis for 21 and over now has 2 locations in Vancouver. The newest shop is on Andreessen Road off Patton Parkway next to Home Depot. The Mill Plain location is in the Heights Shopping Center. Ordering options include online, in person, curbside, and express window touchless pickup to better serve you. Hours and information available at craftcannabis.com.
A big thank you to our founding partners at Morel Inc. Print and Marketing for their ongoing support of community radio. Morel Inc. is a woman-owned, union-staffed, state-of-the-art print shop that since 1993 has offered high-quality, creative, and innovative printing and marketing solutions. Morel Inc.'s experienced staff creates partnerships with their clients and uses the latest technologies to meet their needs. More information about which of Morel Inc.'s products, printing, and marketing strategies will best serve your next project and budget can be found at morelinc.com. That's morelinc.com.
Listening to Smile by the Pat Mallinger Quartet featuring Bill Carruthers. Let's return to our conversation with Pat, recorded in Chicago, here on The Fix on KXRW.
Some of the names and some of the places that you've mentioned have kind of gone by the wayside. But obviously your time that you're spending and all the performing that you're doing at the Green Mill, you've been doing that not only with Sabretooth, you did that until what, 2018 or something like that?
Exactly.
It really last that long?
It did, yeah, it sure did. Yeah, 27 years.
Yeah, 27 years.
Yeah, every Saturday night, you know, for that many years, yeah. It's hard to imagine now that it's not happening, and that I did it that long, And then how long I would have kept on doing it if it wasn't for COVID, right? I'd still be doing it.
Right.
Yeah. And it also taught us that you could do with these things on your own, right? You could create these things on our front porch concerts, you know, for example, turned out to be a thing. And, you know, the neighbors coming up afterwards, you know, when's the next one? When's the next one? You know, yeah.
Excellent.
I mean, so they loved it, and we made decent money, and I don't have to go anywhere. It's, you know.
Yeah.
And I have drums. I can, you know, I bring the drums up there, and I have a little keyboard if somebody wants to bring a keyboard. Now I have a bass, so I'm actually self-contained if they just want to show up.
Right.
And then it makes some decent money too, and have a ball and hang.
I'd like to drop a couple of names, and in doing that, just ask you how in the world, for example, when I think you played with Dave Brubeck, did you?
Yeah.
And how did that go?
It went great. Like, we're at Ravinia, and it was his big band, so we had big band charts, and I was... my favorite thing I took away from, except for the playing with him and just like turning around, Joe Morello was on drums, right? And oh my God, you know, like that's the real deal. Like that's the guy, you know? And then looking over there at Brubeck, he was old, you know? But he was playing, you know, amazingly, you know? I thought, and people felt it too. It was special. But my favorite story to take away from that, as I was practicing right before the rehearsal, I got there a minute early, I guess, and I just sit in my chair, warming up a little bit, and on the stage at Ravinia, and Dave walks in, right, and so I stop playing, right. Like, oh, there he is, man. I better stop playing. But he sits down on the piano, yeah, and you know, smiles and says hi, and you know, and you know, like, hey, you know, see you, you know. And he's playing, warming up a little bit, and then after the show, I went up to him and I said, hey, Dave, you know, it's really been a great honor to play with you, man. It was beautiful, and he's like, well, I walked in this place, I heard the saxophone playing, and then I knew we were going to be okay tonight.
Huh.
And I said, oh, wow, man, that's nice. That's nice to hear.
That is amazing.
Yeah. That's nice story.
Well, you've had the opportunity to play with, I think, Harry Connick Jr., I think Branford Marsalis, who I am a big fan of Branford Marsalis, oh, and nice. I believe that... Harry Connick Jr., I think, studied with his dad, Ellis.
Yeah.
I think he took lessons from him, which must have been pretty, pretty
right.
amazing.
Right.
But Lee Konitz.
Yeah, Lee Konitz, yeah.
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 Yeah. This just...
Yeah. Yeah. Lee Konitz, that was with the Chicago Jazz Ensemble. Yeah. Yeah, that was something. Him standing right in front of me, like, wow, that's him.
Yeah.
That's
so, him. Okay, Herbie Hancock.
You know,
that's of course that also blows my mind that you had the app. I don't know how in depth that was or how long you got, you know how you got to play with him. But Herbie to
right.
me is a giant.
Yeah. Right. Well, we were at the Kennedy Center Awards, and.
Of course you were.
And yeah, performing for the, I was with the jazz members band in Chicago. And we were doing that gig on a regular basis. They did it, I wasn't always with the band, but when I was with the band for a few years, I did it, I don't know how many years I did it, the Kennedy Center, maybe a handful of times. I think I did it maybe five times or something like that. Joel Williams had just passed, and so
great vocalist,
right? Exactly, yeah. So he was our vocalist on that gig for every year. So that was a big loss. Like, now what are we gonna do? Well, we kept the gig, but when we got there, they were like, okay, we have some special guests that are coming in. And we're like, oh, okay, who that is, you know. So we did our thing like we do, and you know, and then they're eating dinner, right, and then there's like a concert afterwards. So that's when Joe Williams would be featured, and so this year it was Herbie and Stevie Wonder, you know. We did a thing, few tunes with them, you know. What I remember taking out of that was Stevie started playing Giant Steps, and I was like, oh
wow.
My god, right? And I'm like, holy crap. And so, like, people were looking at me, right, because I'm playing center, right?
No pressure.
Like, yeah, no pressure, right? So yeah, I stood up and man, I had to play, and Herbie there was playing too, and it was quite a scene.
Yeah, that's mind blowing. That prospect.
Was,
so did that work out all
special,
right?
But it was nerve wracking though too. Like, I can't believe I'm playing for, and you're playing for the state, heads of state, and Walter Cronkite's out there, and all the stars, Lucy, it's mind-boggling. Yeah.
Strikes me that way,
It's pretty cool. Yeah, it's a good experience.
Here's Madeline's lullaby off the album Dragonfish by Pat Mallinger with Dan Trudell. You are listening to The Fix on KXRW.
KXRW programming is made possible by the generous support by David Dansky with David's Toys, buyer and collector of old toy trains, including Lionel, Flyer, Ives, and Marks. He is interested in buying old transportation-related toys as well as toy trains from the late 1800s to the 1960s. David offers appraisals for fellow toy train lovers as well. David's Toys can be reached at 360-576-1602. That's 360-576-1602.
Basketball season is underway and erupting in Vancouver. The Vancouver Volcanoes are welcoming back fans to the O'Connell Sports Center at Clark College in Vancouver, Washington. The Vancouver Volcanoes are a non-profit sports entertainment basketball club dedicated to helping our players develop into professionals on and off the court, growing new basketball fans, and providing great entertainment, value, and service for the community. Come on out for some exciting family-friendly entertainment and enjoy the sights and sounds of local basketball at its best. For tip-off times, tickets, and complete schedule, go to www.vancouvervolcanoes.com.
Welcome back. I'm Bill Haas. Let's rejoin our talk with saxophonist Pat Malinger here on The Fix on KXRW.
I've spoken with other musicians about the truth in the music and being authentic in the music of, you know, that the sound that's coming out is you. The sound that's coming out isn't one of your big influences. I mean, it's like the sax guys that when they're first starting out, you know, they're gonna, well, you mentioned Giant Steps, you know, everybody's trying to get to a place, but it's got to be your place. So if in talking about authenticity and how to get up there so that when you're talking to the audience through your instrument, you're speaking in your voice.
It's funny you say that. My dad would say that, you know, about the, he'd say, Tommy Bauer, he speaks through that instrument. Boy, he speaks, he, you know, that's his voice, you know. To me, that I was too young to, you know, get any the sense of that was profound or understand what he was saying, but now I know what he's saying, you know. Of course, that takes time, you know, for the most part, and then listening, right? Like, I mean, all those hours of listening to so many different people, and you know, has a big impact on you. You know, if you're just listening to one guy all the time, then you're
right.
More prone. Which is, you know, I went through a like train phase, you know, like in college and Steve Grossman and different guys like that, and Joe, you know, Joe, and I mean, yeah, different phases. Yeah, Dexter, pretty much down the line, but probably train had the most influence on me, and I, you know, spent a lot of time listening and getting deep into his music.
And so how'd you get to Pat Malinger?
Well, it's funny. I sometimes just don't hear myself. Like I hear those other guys. I was like, when I hear myself, like, that sounds like Train. Oh, that sounds like Joe Henderson thing. That's a, I was like I don't hear or recognize it. Like, and I'm happy to hear when people tell me that I have my own voice. Mm. You know, I I've gotten that for quite a long time, which is great to hear, because you don't want to hear the alternative, right?
Right. Yes, exactly. Well, you're just like Henderson. This is awesome.
Right. Well, I do remember, like, when I first came into town, and I still, this, like, Mark Tuttle says this, a tenor sax player. He's like, man, yeah, when you first came into town, I thought you were just another Train clone. But man, then I heard you again, and you were, like, totally somewhere else. You, like, playing Sonny or, like, all this other shit, you know? And he's like... so I was like, okay, yeah, that's good, you know, I'm glad. That's funny. He's not the only one. I've heard that, like, people thought I was like a Train clone, because I was, like, when I came here, I think I was most into him, and, you know, kind of sounding a lot like that sound, you know, and
sure.
Approach, and, you know.
Yeah, well, we all stand on the shoulders of giants, or in this case, Giant Steps.
Yeah.
But then we arrive one day somehow.
Right. Right, but I would never think that I arrived to Coltrane's level.
No.
And he did, of course, you know. But yeah, we arrive at our level. You're right, yeah, mm-hmm. for sure.
Yes, exactly. And when I speak of authenticity, meaning telling the truth through your instrument.
Yeah, and that's what matters the most, right? In the end.
It seems to me.
Right, so if that comes across, that's great.
Well, yeah. It does.
Yeah.
It does. And going from that to, because that's something that's kind of a challenge to teach, except for, I don't know if you can say, no, go stand in the corner until you sound like yourself. That's not how it goes.
Right.
But you do teach. And you are, if this is accurate, a saxophone jazz mentor at the Ravinia Jazz Mentor Program.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Right.
And yeah, we are on Facebook, Ravinia Jazz Mentor Program, if people want to follow us.
And
Instagram as well.
Yep. And so, you know, what's that like now being, you know, we come through the ranks and we have our mentors, and then all of a sudden, we're a mentor.
Right, and I was pretty young. I mean, I've been doing it since its inception, and now it's how many years? 27 years. I've been doing that.
Ramsey Lewis started.
Ramsey
that?
Lewis, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. We started in 1995.
Must have been wild. You got the opportunity to play with Ramsey Lewis, and I was a big fan of Ramsey Lewis when I was growing up.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
What was he doing? Did he do The In Crowd? I mean, that was his hit.
Yeah.
But loved his sound.
Yeah, he began the Ravinia Jazz Program, and incidentally, this is confidential. I don't have to give out a date, but there are plans being made for his birthday celebration. At Ravinia this coming summer, and I know a little bit more about it, but I can't say it because the Ravinia schedule hasn't been announced yet, but it's good news, and not that he's going to necessarily play, you know, but we would hope, because he's basically retired and not playing now, but he's been he spearheaded the program and
So that sounds like it'll be an awesome event.
Yeah,
I mean, to have him there and to dedicate to him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it'd be a big event.
Awesome.
Yeah.
What is the Louis Armstrong Legacy Project and Celebration Program? You had mentioned John Faddis.
Yeah,
I think, and he started that, or he created that.
Yeah, I don't know that he started it. He might have been in some of the programming. But yeah, Faddis John Faddis ended up directing the Chicago Jazz Ensemble (CJE), which is sadly now defunct. The band is no longer together, but he took over from. Basically, Scott Hall was the interim, but Bill Russo was Bill Russo's mm-hmm. band. Out of Columbia College, we rehearsed in.
Sure.
And
he was the dean when I went to Columbia.
He was the dean. Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Yeah, wow, I can't imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just.
I went up to his office and once after rehearsal, and he pulled up the drawer. He had a little taste for us, you know, a little whiskey and the glasses and
yeah, so
and lit a cigar, and, you know, like wow, where are we?
That would have that would have blown my mind.
Bill Russo, yeah,
I love him.
Wow, I'm in. Yeah,
yeah. I don't know where I don't know if he had the picture on his wall. It's Duke. And Billy Strayhorn, and Bill Russo.
So we were smoking a cigar one time. I was doing a gig on the south side of Chicago, coming out of the gig, smoking cigars. Bill and I, we're getting to the parking lot, and there's a guy getting back in his car. It was Studs Terkel. And he's like, and Bill's like, Studs. And he's like, oh, come here. Hey, I'd like you to meet Pat Mallinger. And you're like, oh, yeah. And yeah, Studs, man, he gave me the biggest compliment, you know. I mean, I'm not deserving. But he said, you play one of the best saxophonists that I've ever heard. He said, I've heard everybody, you know. He started naming off all these guys. I've heard everybody. And you're up there, you know. You're up there, you know.
Oh,
and I'm
boy.
Like, wow. And I'm like, wow. Yeah, that's so I don't know. I was just thinking about that, you know.
Yeah.
An offhand experience just with Bill Russo, because it made me think about the cigars and the Columbia College.
Any reference with Studs Terkel is also, that's pretty heavy stuff.
That's pretty cool.
Huge Studs fan.
Yeah.
He did so much for,
what a great guy, and too, yeah, he did so much, you're right, exactly, and he's a super, super great guy to talk to, and so complimentary. Yeah.
Well, we're dropping all these names, and everything is really pretty straight-ahead jazz. I mean, it's all the different flavors, but we're talking jazz. I wanted to speak with you about the Grateful Dead.
Yeah,
because you must be a Deadhead,
right? Yeah, you see my Jerry up on.
I see a Jerry next to your Miles Davis.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, you commented on that right away. Jerry and Miles together. Yeah, yeah. I always wondered what that would have sounded like. Yeah, that would have been interesting. Yeah, I mean, it would have been mind-boggling, right?
If somehow or another, if there wasn't this massive collision of personalities.
Right, yeah.
But if they met in the middle in the music, then yeah, that could have been...
Right.
That could have been
yeah.
special.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
But you have an album which is an actual album. It is vinyl as opposed to being on CD. So, and is that called...
Sabretooth Plays Dead?
Sabretooth Plays Dead.
Yep.
And where did that come from? I mean, as much of a fan as you can be, how do you go from just being a Deadhead? It's not an offensive term. There, I said it. I'll say it again. But
no judgment.
To go from there to actually saying, "Hey, let's record this stuff."
Right.
You know, how did you get there?
Well. In the earliest days of Sabretooth, I began bringing in Dead arrangements. I started scripting out arrangements because I thought, you know, I mean, I went to a few shows in the early 90s, before Jerry passed, and I went to four shows, and then when I was listening to the melodies, I was like, oh yeah, there's a lot of melodic content here, a lot of stuff that should be played instrumentally, you know. So that's when I started doing that and recording. We'd get just bootleg recordings from people who'd be recording us, but they were trading them around. We had tapers. It was pretty funny. It's almost like you could get like a Grateful Dead CD. It was pretty cool. So there are tapes out there. Somebody has them. But we began to attract that crowd too, you know, which was interesting. All of a sudden at the Green Mill, you know, there's like these hippies coming in late at night, you know. But they were all totally into the music, you know. I mean, mm-hmm. that's the amazing thing about Dead is, I mean, they're really in tune to the music. They know what it's supposed to sound like. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
I'd say they're wide open.
Right. Yeah. And so it was... We had quite a fan base, you know, developed from that, and it was super cool to see like the kind of the jazz world and the rock, people who normally just would go to rock shows,
mm-hmm.
Coming to the Mill, and you know, and Dave, the owner, pointed that out to me. Actually, you know, he was grateful for that, you know.
He was grateful.
Right. He was, exactly. Yeah. I could do an impression of, you know. Hey, Pat, you know, like, I'm not into, like, this dead thing. But, you know, like, but it's cool, you know. It's kind of cool. You're bringing in all these different people, you know. Yeah, so. Dave was very supportive, and the recording. There were members of the band that had been saying for years that we should record these arrangements, and it really wasn't even me. Like I wasn't. I thought it was a good idea, but there were other guys that were more insistent about we should record this stuff, you know, which totally made sense. But the funny thing is, like, we had been playing less of that stuff in the more recent years, in the latter years of Sabretooth. We were doing less and less of that stuff for whatever reason. And all of a sudden, we had a budget. You know, there was a budget given to us, allotted to us. And so, because of that, we were like, oh, yeah, we got to go in the studio, you know. And the studio is a mile away here. It's the best studio experience, you know, I've ever had. And it's just, you know, the top floor of his house, or you know, this house, you know, and in the attic. And they record this great stuff, and you know, he's really good. And so it was a great experience, but it was kind of interesting. I think we were all of a sudden back into the dead, doing the dead thing, you know. And it kind of took its own shape. Like, it took a while, like a year and a half before we got it out of the studio. It just kind of like lay dormant for a little while, and then we started listening to it more, and I was like, had time then to, like, there was no rush, so, well, let's layer this, let's put this in, which had been a totally different experience for me, you know. I all my recordings, you know, pretty much are live, and if they're not live, they're in this studio I've tried to create a live scene for.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I really appreciate you taking this time to speak with me.
It's nice to chat with you. Always great to reconnect with you when you get to Chicago.
Well, thanks.
And to all my Portland friends out there, too. You know, hopefully, you know, my Portland friends are listening in, you know.
Yeah.
Sending love to them and my friends out on the West Coast. Everybody stay safe, healthy, and I appreciate you inviting me today.
Excellent.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Many thanks again to Pat Mallinger. Let's listen to Pat and Sabretooth's treatment of Uncle John's Band by the Grateful Dead. I hope you dig it as much as I do. For all things Pat Mallinger, visit patmallinger.com. This is Radio's Bill Haas saying thank you for joining us on The Fix on KXRW. Thank you.
things to talk about here beside the rising tide. Come here, Uncle John's band playing to the tide. Come on along or go alone, he's come to take his children home.
KXRW Vancouver Radio is a volunteer-powered and community-supported 501c3 nonprofit organization. As for so many nonprofits, COVID-19 has understandably thrown a huge wrench in our usual live fundraising event efforts and why your support right now would be so helpful. If you like our purpose-driven informative, local talk, and music programming that gives Vancouver a voice and want to help us make more, please consider becoming a KXRW monthly member today. New KXRW merch is in as a fun perk when you sign up. We have two new cool KXRW t-shirt designs to choose from. Here are the following levels of giving. $15 monthly, receive a t-shirt of your choice. $25 monthly, receive one KXRW t-shirt, mug, and tote bag. $50 a month, receive two KXRW t-shirts, two mugs, and two tote bags, plus four tickets to the next KXRW backstage block party. One-time donations are always welcome as well. Every little bit helps us with our monthly operational costs and expanding equipment needs. After all, an informed community is a healthier community, so let's all be a part of the solution and please become a KXRW monthly member today. Go to www.kxrw.fm and click on our merch page for details. Thank you.